Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Sam Quinones, whose fascinating new book is The Perfect Tuba, Forging Fulfillment from the Bass Horn, Band, and Hard Work. Sam Quinones is the author of four books of narrative nonfiction, including the National Book Critics Circle Award finalist The Least of Us and New York Times bestseller and National Book Critics Circle Award winner Dreamland, the true tale of America's opiate epidemic. He lives with his family in Tennessee. And today we're talking about his new book, which is about something a little different. It's called The Perfect Tuba, Forging Fulfillment from the Bass Horn, Band, and Hard Work. Sam Quinones, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, it's great to be with you, sir. Thank you very much.
There is so much joy and heartbreak in this single book. It's an astonishing collection of experiences all woven into one glorious history.
Thank you. That's really great to hear. Believe me, it's a huge risk. I did not think I'd ever write a book about the tuba.
Well, you started work on it because you were looking for something a little lighter and happier than your previous subjects. You soon found that there were commonalities as well with those. But talk about that change in direction and your obsession, because that's what shines through in this book, is that obsession.
Sure. I had written two books about our national epidemic of drug addiction. First, opioids, painkillers, and heroin. The last one about fentanyl, methamphetamine. But in general, though, those books were about people who were searching for happiness from something they buy. And I think that's actually kind of a national syndrome, frankly, in this country. It's what corporate marketers really want us to buy into. I wanted them to write, after that 12 years of that, talking about it and traveling around, I wanted to write about people who were looking for fulfillment from something they mastered, from skills they developed from within, not looking for some happiness from outside, but the cultivating the skills through hard work, through patience, devotion, focus, collaboration with others was very important in all this. And so I fastened on a book about tuba players and band directors, largely because I'd written about tuba players when I worked at the LA Times many years ago, kept on interviewing them, and they were fascinating folks.
I love it that you see the tuba as an optimistic instrument. Explain that for us.
It's optimistic in that nobody chooses the tuba. The tuba assigned to you first day of band class, usually because you were late. But through the cultivation, again, of your skills and your perseverance despite failure, this is what I found in many tuba players. They came to understand their own capabilities that they really didn't understand were possible until they undertook the tuba. And that this seemed to me to be such an important thing for people to hear nowadays. We are constantly inundated with the idea, like, the easy way, don't worry about it, take some time off, or let's have a magic answer that solves all our problems. The tuba players felt to me like these folks who were finding from within something that had never occurred to them. And when they found that, that was like the most exhilarating thing in their lives almost. And it was such it showed them what was possible. And to me, that's an extraordinarily optimistic idea that you can find from within what you are capable of. And that was the story of many tuba players to a T.
Well, I love that when you introduce us to Willie Clark, you say, you know, he was tiny and he couldn't actually hold that instrument, but he climbed into it and it was his. And that sense of it is an enveloping musical instrument.
Well, it was. He was in sixth grade.
Yeah.
and what struck me was, you know, I would ask these players sometimes, what do you remember the first moment, and mm-hmm. it really struck you that you loved about this impossibly difficult horn to play at sixth grade? It is not easy. Your lung capacity is not really there. And he remembered that moment when he played the first note in the theme to Star Trek with his sixth grade band at a competition somewhere in the Chicago area. And he just blew so hard, and he took the band with him as he just kind of took off with that one big B-flat note. And it was a note he still remembered when he was 55, and that was meeting him for the first time and telling me, this is what really, when I felt that, after that, everything was exciting about the tuba. Nothing was overly hard.
Well, then tell us about the first time you held a tuba.
There's absolutely no justice in that story. So the book is called The Perfect Tuba because it threaded through the book as the story of these two perfect tubas, the most perfect expression of tuba in the world right now, which are owned, both of them, by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. These are tubas viewed as like holy grail tubas. Mm-hmm. Nine companies have tried to replicate these two tubas that were made by the York Instrument Company of Grand Rapids, Michigan, in the 1930s. They've never been really perfectly replicated. They are viewed as these kind of sacred horns by tuba players. And I was hearing about these tubas for years, really, literally, until I finally was in the same room with them in Chicago at the Symphony Hall there. And Gene Picorni, who is currently and been many years then the Chicago Symphony's tuba player, said, "Hey, you want to play one of those?" And I'm like, just very offhand. Now, here's the thing. Every tuba player I know wants to play those tubas. I have never played the tuba. It's the first time I ever tried to make a sound on the tuba. First of all, those tubas are, as they write in the book, they're about as big as a linebacker. They take up that kind of space. And then trying to make a sound on those, I'd probably like stroke out before I actually make an intelligible. So the sound that I sat there making sounds very much like my stomach growling, like that. And I was overwhelmed by this feeling like if any one of 100 tuba players saw me doing this, they would say, there's just no justice. This guy has not put in the time. He doesn't know how to play this thing. But yet that was the very first time I ever tried to play the tuba was on one of the two most perfect tubas that humankind has ever created.
What luck. What luck.
Indeed.
Both
indeed.
Good
very
and bad.
Weird.
I mean,
I'm not necessarily proud of it, let me tell you that. A lot of guys would say, what? How come I can't play that thing?
But it's such a great origin story, the two mythical instruments.
Oh, it's really, as I said, I began doing tuba interviews after doing some tuba stories when I worked at the LA Times in 2011. I just never stopped interviewing tuba players because, again, I felt like there's this thing about, in my life as a journalist, if you find people who are doing something for the pure love of it and not for wealth or fame, promise of adulation or anything like that, but simply because they have learned to love it and it has showed them what they are capable of, if you follow those people, you will find some really great stories. But also along the way, couple of guys told me the story of these two mythical, legendary tubas, equal to the tuba, what the Stradivarius violins are to the violin as an instrument. And with that, I never forgot that. These perfect tubas, they're out there. People have tried to replicate them and on and on. It was just such a beautiful, amazing, unexpected story. So I kept at it. I probably would have dropped the whole project had it not been for that one promise that there's these two tubas out there and I could write about them. No one else has written about them. They're the most important horns in the tuba world, and they're just waiting for me to write about them.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sam Kanonis. His new book is The Perfect Tuba, Forging Fulfillment from the Bass Horn, Band, and Hard Work. The other thing you write about are great tuba teachers, and one of them was Hubert Estel Nutt, who came up with the 8 teaching points for tubas and the great philosophy of start, sustain, release the note. So talk about H.E. Nutt.
H.E. Nutt is this wiry, thin guy who became almost like a monk of music at a school that he helped found in Chicago, known as the Vandercook College. And he was this guy who helped found the thing and then kind of devoted his entire life to teaching kids how to be the best band directors, school, high school band directors they could be. And he distilled it all down into almost like Buddhist talking points. Mm-hmm. So these eight teaching points, one of which is play one note well. Start the note, sustain the note, release the note. Make sure that, you know, train your kids in how to play one note well. And if they achieve this through really arduous repetition and work, but work that they grow to love, they will then, that will be the foundation for the rest of their playing. And they will have incorporated some of the great lessons of music and, frankly, of discipline, that mm-hmm. you stick with something until you play it perfectly. And the guy was like that. He almost had no other interests. Everybody, you know, he didn't take a salary. He just took some money occasionally from the school, but lived in an apartment at the school with his wife, Thelma Nutt, but was nevertheless one of the most important, influential teachers in the entire band directing world in the United States. I think you have to call him that, one of the really great founding visions of band directing, which is itself an amazing world, because mm-hmm. what do band directors teach? They teach the great values that sustain community, patience, punctuality, focus, collaboration with others, perseverance despite failure. All of these are values that really sustain community, and that's what I also came to understand, both about tuba players and about band directors. They are teaching something that is so important, and it is especially important nowadays, this age of constant distraction and so on. Just found them to be super important, and he is kind of like this founding visionary of all that.
And you found communities like this all over the country, but you especially settle on one in the Rio Grande Valley in South Texas, and the way it's transformed by its band culture, especially in Rio Grande City and a little town called Roma. And I right. wonder if you yeah. talk about that.
Roma, Texas is a dinky town out in the middle of nowhere, right at the very northern end of the Rio Grande Valley, which means it's far from interstates, it's far from everything. And yet, it is one of the great state competitors in marching band in the state of Texas. And I wanted to tell the story of how that happened. And when I dug into how that happened, I came upon the guy who really started it, which was a guy named Al Cortinas, now I think 78, 79 years old. Is Al? Wonderful guy, cheerful, energetic, and he developed a system through which he could. These are towns, Roma and many of those towns are towns where nobody really can afford private music lessons. So the band has to be where they learn all of this. And he developed a system that was supported by the school administrators in the town of Roma, to hire a bunch of band directors, each of which would be the instructor in their specific instrument, flute or clarinet, mm-hmm. and horn, drums, whatever. And through this system that he implanted, the Cortina system in Roma, Roma went from a band that really literally never marched, couldn't march, barely could play, to one of the great competitive bands in the state of Texas, competing against much wealthier schools from, say, the tech suburbs of Austin or the suburbs of Dallas. And that story is also, though, connected to H.E. Nutt, because Al Cortinas, when he was forming his band system, took a lot of influence from the school bands in Brownsville, and many of the teachers in the town of Brownsville, Texas, were followers of H.E. Nutt and had come from the school in Chicago, the Vandercook College of Music. Yeah. And so it was all this fascinating world of influences, all getting back to H.E. Nutt, but then having its expression in this little town of Roma many, many years later through what Al Cortinas had invented.
And I love that he taught the kids to love their practice times. And he said, just don't let them figure out it's hard. I mean,
right. All these kids, he saw this firsthand. He said, I propose stuff like, I think the first time, a Carmina Burana, which is a very, very difficult thing for kids who were basically almost musically illiterate 2 years before. And they began to, and he played a form over the speakers in the band room. And they're like, whoa, you know, can we play that? And he says, sure, yeah. Don't tell him, oh, I don't know if he could ever play that. No, he says, just don't tell him it's hard. Kids will rise to the level you set. If you set the standards low, they'll meet it. If you set the standards high, they'll meet that. Just don't tell them it's hard. It's a wonderful way of educating kids, seemed to me.
And these guys were so generous with their time and their money, driving the kids around, taking them to McDonald's.
You couldn't be a band director in Roma, Texas, or some of those little spread out towns down in the Rio Grande Valley otherwise, because those kids didn't have cars.
Yeah.
Their families, their mother and dad, they were working. And so it was the teachers, the band teachers, who had to take them home at 7, 8, 9 o'clock every night because, and people lived really far away from it. It was particularly back in those days, in the late 90s, where there was not as much, not as heavily populated as it is today. And so people just live far away. And so it was the band director who was the taxi driver, as well as many other things.
Now, of course, no story about brass band music is complete without a stop in New Orleans. And our city is rich
That's
in the
right.
tuba tradition. So you chose the late, great Tuba Fats as a representative figure. So talk a little bit about what you discovered and experienced here.
Yes, I did, because I came to understand that Tuba Fats was probably the most important tuba player the town has ever produced. I mean, there's a riff in New Orleans called Tuba Fats. I mean, that's what people, for the jazz funeral, propelling the jazz funeral, frequently the Tuba Fats riff. But also, I have to say, what I was looking for was not a typical story about tuba in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it in Tuba Fats, even though he kind of typifies the tuba and is this greatly influential guy. What I loved about his story was that it was actually a love story.
Yes.
He falls in love with this big woman, a belter, who comes in from out of town named Linda Young, who herself has this kind of story that even her family didn't quite understand
mm-hmm.
Very well. But she was as iconoclastic and marching to the beat of her own drummer as was Tuba Fats. And they meet two enormous people. Tuba Fats was probably like 6'5". Well over 300 pounds. Linda Young was not that big, but big in personality. And they kind of meet together. And for several years, they form this beautiful love story / music story. Linda and Tuba kind of do better because of each other. They loved mm-hmm. each other, but they also liked each other. And they like spending time with one another. All of this kind of seemed to me to be about the time when, just as the tuba, this was the late 80s, early 90s, into the mid-90s, when the tuba was becoming kind of emblematic of the economic realities of New Orleans, whereby, in fact, Tuba's story was very much like that. His father, a black man, had come to New Orleans to get work as longshoreman in the late 40s, back when there was longshore work. The story of Tuba Fats' family, the real name was Anthony Layson. The Layson family was very much that of New Orleans, where, you know, at first it was longshore work, but then that disappeared. And so Tuba Fats was making his money playing for tips on Jackson Square. That's really where he made his name and his livelihood. And so the story of Tuba Fats allowed you to tell a great tuba story, a great economic story, where, you know, if you subtracted the tuba out of New Orleans, what would you actually have, you know, in terms of the tourism, the music that has propelled the town since the decline of longshore work and manufacturing and all that. And it was also this beautiful love story, both
yeah.
love story from Tuba Fats and Linda, but also a kind of the love story of tuba for his music and his city's music. I think I write in the book that he was like the Mississippi River.
Mm-hmm.
He, in musical Mississippi River, he contained within him and it incorporated all the great styles of music, jazz, gospel, funk, on and on, almost like doo-wop, all this kind of music that he had grown up on. He had it within him and it flowed through his horn.
If If you're just joining us, my guest is Sam Quinones. His new book is The Perfect Tuba, Forging Fulfillment from the Bass Horn, Band, and Hard Work. Well, this is such a wonderful book about time and its uses, and what happens if we really take the time to follow our obsessions. And it's amazing where that path will take us, and it's transformational in the lives of young people particularly, and, you know, as you write about it, in whole communities.
That was one of the beauties of this, and that's one of the things, thanks for the question again, because that's one of the things that really excited me, because here I have been writing about the sad, depraved search for quote-unquote happiness from buying some piece of crud from the dealer down the street or in some motel. All the while, kids in band, tuba players, band directors were finding what we are all looking for, which is an exhilaration that comes from purpose in life, but also working really hard at something and then finally achieving it. They were finding that exhilaration all around me. And here, as I was writing about people looking for happiness from something they buy, they had found the real answer to a lot of this, to how do you keep kids from getting involved in drugs? Push them. Don't coddle them. Push them to do things that are hard and find their own path in life. Find their own, as I say in the very last sentence of the book, how do you keep kids from, I'm not sure exactly how you keep kids from getting involved in drugs, but one thing I might tell people now is push your kids to find their own perfect tuba.
Right. So what has this done for you? How do you top this now? Because you came to this fork in the road and...
You were too kind. You know, here's the thing. I love journalism. I found my own perfect tuba in journalism. And so I don't know. I don't think about that. All I think about is whether the next story I'm doing, the next story to the absolute most pristine and achieving the most absolute pristine beauty with that story, that story is capable of producing. Can I do that? And if I do that, then I'm happy. And I don't really think about almost anything else, and it my experience has shown me that if I do that, other people will love it too, most of the time anyway.
Yeah.
And so I have not thought that about that question that you just asked, but I just keep on focusing on how do I find stories that astound me, that leave me just breathless, breathtaking stories that require a lot of immersion, a lot of hard work, a lot of re-interviewing multiple times of people who are involved in it. And when I find that, I'm happy. You know, that's enough.
Well, it's such a big-hearted book, and it's such an excellent adventure, Sam, and I'm glad I got to share it with you.
So appreciate your wonderful questions, and thank you so much, Sue, for your interest. And say hello to everybody in NOLA, one of my all-time favorite towns in the world.
You bet. We've been talking with Sam Quinones, whose new book is The Perfect Tuba, Forging Fulfillment from the Bass Horn, Band, and Hard Work. Sam, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure is mine.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Allen Iverson signs his memoir, Misunderstood, Friday, October 10th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. This is a ticketed event, and space is limited. Jessica Gross discusses and signs their novel, Open Wide, Friday, October 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Dickens Fellowship continues its reading of David Copperfield with chapters 16 through 21, Saturday, October 11th at 2 at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. Paula Saunders signs Starting From Here, Monday, October 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Delaney Nolan signs her novel, Happy Bad, and appears in conversation with Josh Wheeler, Tuesday, October 14th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Liminal Reading Series presents readings and performances by Tad Bartlett, Danny Cherry Jr., Christine Kwan, and K.R. Seagriff, Thursday, October 16th at 6 at 12 Mile Limit. And coming up, the Friends of the Jefferson Parish Library hold their big book sale Friday through Sunday, October 24th through 26th at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are Friday and Saturday from 10 to 7 and Sunday, October 26 from noon to 5. Free admission, free parking. This used book sale is one of the largest in our area with over 65,000 items for sale. Gently used adult and children's books, puzzles, DVDs, CDs, records. The auction items this year are Fashion, The Definitive History of Costume and Style, The Birds of America, a reprint of the book by Audubon, Sugar Bowl Classic, A History by Marty Muley, and Masters of the Battlefields by Major General Julian Thompson. Cash and credit cards accepted, no checks. Email friendsjpl@yahoo.com for more information. And vote for the One Book, One New Orleans selection for 2026. Visit the group's Facebook page for more info. The three choices are the nonfiction work Brown Pelican by Ryan Fertel, the poetry collection Libre by Sky Jackson, and the novel Far Away From Here by Ambata Kazi. The New Orleans Poetry Festival is set for April 16th through 19th, 2026, and proposal submissions are open until December 1st, 2025. Notifications will be sent out on December 15th. The confirmation deadline for all accepted presenters is January 1st, 2026. Waitlist decision notifications will be sent January 15th. Individual reader proposals will open on January 15th, close on January 29th, and notifications will be sent out February 4th. Check out nolapoetry.com for complete information. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.